This isn't just a podcast about leadership. It's about the patterns that run us, the scripts we inherit, and the beliefs we reinforce without even realizing it. We've watched this work rekindle marriages, renew parents' connections with their kids, and reimagine the future of businesses. So if you've ever found yourself asking, "Am I becoming the person I'm supposed to be?" you're in the right place. This is In the Arena, conversations about what it really means to live and lead well. Welcome to In the Arena. My name is Sean Dyke, managing partner here. Joining me today, the ever amazing Chris Stimp.
Thanks.
And Chris, you came to me the other day with an observation that we thought would be a fun and intriguing conversation to have here.
Yeah, look, one of the benefits of working here, amongst many, is we are, around your wisdom and those that work here. But in truth, one of the things I noticed is a lot of times the stories, the anecdotes, the lessons you've learned have some military component due to your time in the military.
Yeah.
You don't talk about the military time too much, but I noticed, it seems like he learned a lot in those years.
Yeah, yeah.
And as many listening know, military is often considered a height of leadership. So there's a lot of transition into what we do. So I want to sit down and talk to you about what did you learn there that has transitioned to the senior leaders you work with today?
Awesome. Love it. And appreciate the chance to chat through it. Because it is true, I don't necessarily speak to it that often. Sometimes,
right.
If people have been around long enough, we get to go through it. So can I set a frame for a little bit?
Please do.
A little latitude to set a frame for anybody listening inside of this. I also think that there's various different levels of affinity toward the military.
Yeah.
And some love it, some are anti it. It's a complicated space. And I think for me, my headspace leans into the extraction of the experiences that I had from it. And so the goal would be leaning into that. But I'll give a little bit of detail in case somebody's listening. Grew up in rural, small town, Idaho, a little place called Cuna. At the time, there's like 1,000 people. We had a yellow flashing light outside of town, stop sign in town. It was very, very small. Like you had a hardware store, a grocery store, like 6 churches and 6 bars. I think that's like the balance. It's only like 4 bars really, but so small little place. Nobody in my family had gone to college before, and I really wanted to go to college, but wasn't in a spot that being able to fund it was going to happen. My dad was a Marine, and a buddy of mine that I was in high school with told me that he went down to the recruiting station and he was going to do the military as an experience. It helped pay for college. And my favorite part of this story is that at the time he was looking at joining the Navy, they had what was called a buddy program, which yes, all the flack associated with it, as you can imagine. But basically it meant you guys went to boot camp together, you were deployed together, and so you could hang with your buddy. And
I was like, about brilliant marketing.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Like, come on.
Reduce some of the fear.
Yeah.
Come and join, right? So yeah. I go down, I went through the processing, did all the testing. I get in, and then my buddy didn't graduate high school. So
you're without a buddy.
So that didn't work. Yeah. So I went. Right. So that was first. Like, oh, jazz a bummer.
That's amazing. But,
so I go to boot camp. And then I ended up, I'll back into it, but I ended up with it's called Strike Fighter Squadron VFA-94. It's an FA-18 Hornet Squadron fighter attack jets out of Lemoore Naval Air Station, California. And so I was ground crew and support for them. I was an enlisted guy, not an officer for those that listen. Incredible experience, massively foundational. But I tried to think about when we had sort of briefly talked about this, I tried to think more discreetly about, well, what were some of the things that I pulled out from it? So I got a few
Okay.
I can chase if we will.
Before you do, question, if you go back to 20-year-old Sean on a boat doing whatever you did, was there any leadership bend in your future?
Like, that's great.
You know what I mean?
Were
you actively going, I'm going to use my time for this?
So at 20, a little more. At 18, when I went in,
I was right out of high school.
Right out, yeah.
Oh,
I joined when I was 17 because I graduated when I was 17. It was in a delayed entry program. As soon as I turned 18 in July, a month later, was in.
Let's just clarify for those listening, you do now have multiple degrees.
Yeah, this is true. Yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure
in the event we need to, undergraduate and MBA now.
Okay, I just wonder.
No, so that was the goal, right? The goal was to be able to fund the formal academic experience. But in truth, That's kind of a perfect example where we'll tee into this. I was a pretty shy kid. I didn't have like a strong sense of self early on. And my goal when I was going into boot camp was to just fly under the radar as much as I could. I wanted to be quiet. I wanted to do the right things. Because I had a belief that, I was going to join and there were going to be all these adults there. I was a kid in my mind still.
Right.
Right. So I thought there's going to be a series of people that are going through boot camp with me, that these are adults. And in my mind, I think as a youth, you have this formation or this belief that, like, I don't know, once you hit 18 or 19 or 20, like
you grow up,
you like it just magically occurs and you have all the things figured out. And so I thought, like, gosh, these people are going to be studied and competent and capable and ready and revered and all these different pieces. And so I was like, wow, I kind of went in. We know this now. I didn't know it then. The frameworks we know now, so much of those early formations for me were existing, but I didn't know them. Mm-hmm. So I was going into it very sort of turtling, very mm-hmm. the posture of insecure, uncertain, bit of a distress space around, man, how do I not get in trouble and how do I go in quietly?
Right.
So the first thing I realize is that is not true. There is no version where you hit a magical age and the formation of competency, care, capability, reasoning, perspective, insight, that those don't just materialize based on age. I found that I had a range, and this isn't disparaging to my colleagues, my shipmates in that space. We all had a range of, we were still kids. So there was a range between probably 18 to 30 year olds that were in the room with varying different abilities to regulate emotion, to support one another, to be direct, to navigate complexity and ambiguity. It wasn't as if this competency just descended upon everybody when they're 18. And as an adult looking back on that, that almost seems sort of foolish that you would have thought that way.
Right.
So the parallel that I think I've extracted from this over time is people still in this day and age, when we encounter individuals at, pick the age range, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, they still may not have amassed all of these capability sets that we think and or project on them that we want them to have. You know this, there's a quote on my laptop. It says, it is a hard thing realizing people aren't who you want them to be. Mm-hmm. That experience for me was foundational in recognizing the extent to which we project expectations onto others that they never agreed to, that they've not bought into. And then in some ways we hold them accountable to, and we have disappointment if they aren't the people that we thought they were going to be.
What you're capturing is kind of recognizing that in your early days, but not necessarily noticing the lesson that you will carry forward from that recognition.
No.
It's only kind of in hindsight that Entirely. The lesson is learned. How do you then leverage that in the work we do?
Yes.
Both for self and for those you work with, who hire you, et cetera.
Are we willing to allow people to learn? So I think one of the challenges we navigate across the board these days is that we have this expectation that people are already formed and capable in all of their spaces. They're going to stumble. They're going to mess up. They're going to make mistakes. And the world is pretty critical of people these days. And so we have a hard time allowing people to go through the learning process of becoming.
You know, I could imagine where that comes into play a lot in, let's call it, the professional sphere.
Yeah.
Is when we have somebody, let's say on our team, right? And it's like, okay, they should know how to do this. And then when they don't, we put a judgment around it without saying, well, maybe they just learn it and we move on.
Or let's take it to something even maybe more egregious.
Okay, good.
Let's take it to, like, it's not that there's just a skill underdeveloped. They do something like wrong.
Right.
Like they're aggressive in their tonality with someone. Their listening skills are underdeveloped. And so they look aloof or disengaged or dismissive of you. And then what we do is we create formations about that individual based on this observed experience that is likely a pattern that they've acquired somewhere that hasn't been guided or corrected. I often use, there's a gentleman that was the head of a business for a long time. He was promoted up through the ranks and he'd been in role for 17 years and he had a lot of opportunity. He was not an easy recipient of feedback. And so he rarely got it. So I was asked to coach him. When I interviewed him, I was a little bit anti it because I'm conscious that if it feels like success is improbable, then I don't feel like I want to, you know, tell the client system that we can make this work when we can't.
Sure.
However, I felt like I literally told the group that I was working with, I have about a 20% success anticipation. So if we lean really hard and we work, then maybe. And yeah. They said, let's try. And then the phrase we use often is like, with kindness and care, we dropped an anvil on him, made him very aware with a mirror. And his comment through sadness was, why has no one ever told me this?
Wow.
So I think that's one of the pieces we do frequently is we project onto people something we hope and or expect that a skill they possess and can do. When they don't do it, we have disappointment, dissatisfaction around their underdeveloped skill. And often they've never been given the feedback, guided, or the opportunity to even demonstrate it. And if they do screw it up, we don't approach it with kindness and grace. We approach it with condemnation around their fail state.
You know what is so crazy? Like actively learning this on the spot. My initial headspace went to something tactical, executional, knowledge-based, sure. Right? Now that you say it, it's actually much more rare that we fault somebody for that.
Correct.
We are far more tolerant if it's like, well, I just don't know how to do that. I don't know how to use this new AI technology. I don't know. That's okay. You can learn. Leaders know. That's okay. You can learn. But when somebody doesn't speak up the right way, provides feedback incorrectly, you know, doesn't have that tough conversation, whatever it is, it's about the person,
correct.
Not the skill.
Correct.
That's fascinating.
So you've got
you're right.
This series of attributes that we associate and assign to the person and the personality of who the individual is.
Right. Yeah.
Versus a discrete capability set.
Right,
and so I think that was one of the ones for me.
Love it.
Early on, didn't know it at the time, of course.
Right.
Started becoming aware of, I thought the people in the room that because there were at times, I remember standing in ranks in boot camp and, you know, having a 25-year-old that was so much older than me, that was just making some foolish calls and some decisions that didn't make sense. In my head thinking, how are they making these calls? They're an adult, right? So this use this construct of an adult when we think about cascading expectations on individuals in your organization. This happens with it's just juxtapose it with the word leader.
I was just about to say, and even get crazy, executive, C-suite level.
They've got it all figured out.
They must, if they do something this way, it's because that's who they are and they, as opposed to maybe they got to learn that.
Yes.
I love
and
this.
And are we willing to extend grace to go through it? Right.
Hopefully you got a couple more of these because that one was good.
I do. This was a kind of a comical or funny one for me to learn. So I teed up early on that I really wanted to fly under the radar, right? But I felt like it was important to like prep for things. So going in, you get a little bit of information, not a lot, but you get things like you're going to need to know your general orders, which are a set of orders that all of the different branches of the service have that are sort of core and fundamental around how you operate.
Okay.
The collective chain of command from the president or all the way down through, you know, various different names and rankings. And so I studied those because I thought that's what you should do going in. I found that not all that many people did that when I went in. So I had a little bit of preparation for that. And they create a rank structure in boot camp. That means they have collar insignias. Like they give you different people in boot camp.
That's like the stripes insignias. And stuff?
So it's literally like a pinned on emblem that goes on your collar.
Got it.
That denotes that you have some sort of positional rank.
Okay.
Now once you're out of boot camp, those are earned through time and what you're doing. But in boot camp, you're learning to create a structure. Well, when they initially give out these collar insignia, the company commanders that when I was in Navy boot camp, they give them out early and they don't know yet. They try to observe behavior of people and they start to give them to people. So I was given a collar insignia for what's called assistant master at arms. And so basically it was helping be responsible for any time that we weren't marching. So if we were, you know, in class or we were in eating or wherever we were, like helping lead and guide the group. I had no idea how to do this. And they literally just sort of taught. I remember, I can see the moment where Petty Officer Manabusan, this guy tosses me this collar insignia. And I was like, oh no, I didn't want to lead. I wanted to fly under the radar.
Right.
Now I have to be center stage.
Right.
And I had only one way of knowing how to connect and relate with people. And it was through harmonizer doorway.
Right.
Through friend.
Yeah.
Through kindness.
I want to be liked. Just if you like me, we're good. I'm doing my job.
So I tried to lead that way.
In the military, which probably
in boot camp with a lot of people that are older than me in various different headspaces. And so I stylistically started applying my natural instinct on how I felt comfortable leading. Now, I later, now 30 years later, would look back on that. And if I was to use an aggressive way of describing it, I would call it lazy leadership. Mm. It's defaulting to the style that you're comfortable with versus leading in the way in which the people need to be led.
Yeah.
And so I remember literally being like, at one point in time, there was a group of the team and they were being really loud. And I was like, we're going to get in trouble. And I was pleading, hey guys, come on. Hey, we're going to get in trouble. Hey, for me, let's quiet down. And it's not what was needed.
Right.
In that spot, there was a level of clarity, a level of command, a level of expectation, certainty, and confidence that people were looking to listen to. So I had to really on the fly learn to shift. I was clearly inadequate at it, but got better through that process and going through this piece that realizing leadership is not about expressing my preferred style. It's understanding what the people I lead actually need.
Right.
How do I adjust real time to lead them in a way that's going to invite them to where they need to be? Sometimes now we know it. I didn't know Ken Blanchard's situational leadership at the time.
Yeah.
I knew the early stage formation of people were not responding to the way that I was leading with them and had to learn how to shift my style and how uncomfortable it was for me to lean in to a different style that was needed than the one that I wanted to demonstrate.
There's a couple of things there. One, when you just highlighted how uncomfortable it was. I think very few leaders today, maybe I'm giving too much credit, but have not heard this idea of lead the way they want to be led, right?
Yeah.
I think the challenge becomes that only works until it gets too uncomfortable for you and then you revert. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like, when it's all good and everything's going well, fine, I can try to focus on them. But I find it's the moment that things get tough or when you feel that discomfort, are you most likely to revert to the pattern of leadership that makes you feel okay? Because it's also the pattern you utilize most often in your life.
And that's a you problem,
right? There you go.
That goes back to that's you serving you, not them.
So well put.
When you're dead on correct, I mean, it's my capability set to be more refined and variable and elastic stylistically when I'm good out of distress, as we call it, it's higher. Mm-hmm. But when tension gets high, when stress spikes, when pressure's elevated, when the time frame or constraints elevate, then I literally have an internal physiological response and you can feel yourself lock in to the style that you want to revert to. And oftentimes that's a pretty suboptimal style.
This is going to be a slight aside, but I think valuable for some listening because it was valuable for me when it happened. But I remember not too long ago, got a team and did what you're talking about. So started to lead in the way I naturally am, which is this harmonizer rebel. So let's be friends and let's have fun. And as long as we do that, you'll do what I need you to do, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And
it's easy for me.
Exactly. Oh, yes. Yeah. It's easy for me and it feels comfortable.
Yeah.
We're going to avoid a little bit of conflict, et cetera. And it works at first. But then what I noticed is now I need to influence and I've built a foundation of friendship. I built a foundation of joviality, of ease. Don't worry about it. We can do this. Not a big deal. And I didn't know how to get out of it. You know, this is 6 months in now. So for one day to come up and show up sharp or disappointed or whatever I needed in that moment, I just didn't know how to get there.
Yeah.
What do you recommend if you're hearing this for the first time and you're recognizing maybe I've been leading an easy way, the way that that I want to be led, but not the way they want to be led. And now I don't know how to get out of that because they know me this way.
Yeah. We got to have the self-awareness to even get there. So well, I think to your point,
that's why we're doing it,
right? So you start to recognize stylistically the approach that I'm actively employing isn't serving me. So option one is I know how to do it differently. I just don't want to because it's uncomfortable and awkward. And then the solution sets for that are different than I don't have an installed behavior pattern that I even know how to access or use. Mm. So if I don't know how to do the thing, it is literally a skill building space. I have to create capability in it. One of the guys I coached forever, excellent, brilliant, super capable man, was not having the effect he needed to have. He was smart enough to know it, but he had no idea what he needed to do differently. And so he reached out and we started walking through, what are you doing? What are you wanting to have done? So this is that two question set. Do you know what you want? Most people say yes. Do you know how to get it? Most people say no.
Right.
Okay, great. So let's work on how you need to get it. So for him, we had to work on actively employing new capability sets to get there. And this, again, we said this on a couple episodes ago, whenever we said, which I think is fundamentally true on everything in life, that the solution is never as big as the problem. A simple example with this individual, he was having a hard time creating connection and relatability with people. It's a CFO of a company. And I said, to what extent do you put yourself in the population to do that? Well, I don't. Okay. And then when you put yourself in that population, what is your demeanor? Well, CFO serious.
Yeah.
Right. That's my demeanor. Okay. We'll stop. So literally I want you in the break room at least 3 times a day with a smile.
That's so funny. I love you're teaching us as we go here, but first of all, the CFO serious.
Yeah.
And second of all, quick aside, I was at an event, a social event recently, and I was kind of grumpy and I didn't feel well and all these things.
Just
and,
not like you.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not like me at all, but I could feel that I didn't want to be there. And it was like causing me anxiety because usually I want to be there and I know. And I genuinely in my head was like, well, then just be different. So this is 100% true. And I was like, you're here for 30 minutes. Just be the guy you wish you could be in this moment. And so I was like, I'm going to smile. It might be ridiculous. And I'm going to go joke and I'm going to tap someone on the shoulder. And then next thing you know, it's all good. And we leave. And I was like, I'm glad I did it that way. The reason I articulate that story, one, it's so fresh, but two, because in this instance, the problem is not as big, or I'm sorry, the solution is not as big as the problem
at all.
It's like, okay, so go put yourself in that population and try to be a little bit more jovial or
literally
connect.
Just smile and say, hey. And he literally says to me, will that matter? And I said, bud, so you're the CFO of the organization. When you're in the break room and getting a cup of coffee and you turn to the individual next to you with a smile and you say like, how's the day going? And they're going to respond. They're going to go home and tell their significant other that that happened. Like awesome. It Love does it. Matter. You Love forget it. That. Caitlin, our colleague, oftentimes says, I think leaders forget that, like, and organizations, those executives at those senior levels, she always described them as they're like Santa Claus. Like you don't get to interact with them a lot. You believe that they're executing at these incredibly high levels. They've got a lot of wisdom, command, and responsibility. And it's not this pedestal placement, but it's a reverence and a respect for it that is appreciated. So to your point, I would encourage leaning into there. And then what you just said will remind that phrase of sometimes you think your way into behaving and sometimes you behave your way into thinking. And so you chose to behave your way into thinking.
Yeah.
Right. In those spots.
I think that's important. I know we kind of are wandering, but I'll bring us back because that's what I do here. But, you know, again, many listening come through the doorway of being cerebral, having to think through something, having to understand the logic behind it. And it is funny as I think about my moment or you think about this one, how many times you can go like, this doesn't have to be authentic. This doesn't have to be real or logical. I can just say, I want to be this person in this moment because I think it's what's needed for the outcome and then go do that.
Yeah. Well, and interestingly, I would argue that that is authentic. It may not correlate to the internal feeling state.
Right.
But it's still an authentic expression
That's
with
not
intention.
Inauthenticity. Yeah. It's intentional behavior modification almost.
100%.
Good.
So Brad Spencer, one time, I'm like working here for like a year and he had one of the best lines ever. We're walking through the parking lot and we bumped into somebody and they seemed like these incredible folks. And we walked away and I said, they seem like a really authentic person. And he says, authenticity is incredibly important. You got to learn to fake that shit. And I was like, Brad, come on.
That's so good.
It was a comical statement of hilarious truth around sometimes like you're in those spots where it's not that you're being incongruent or this collective dissonance with who you are.
Right.
It's finding a way in that moment to authentically be present for the individual, even though they don't match. You know how we talk about-
Or be who you want to be.
Yes, yes.
That doesn't mean it. I authentically want to be the CFO who people like in this moment.
Yes.
Naturally, I haven't been. But trying that on doesn't make me inauthentic. It makes me strive. It's Perfect. Learning.
Yep. You know how we sometimes say that confidence is a behavior and an emotion, mm-hmm. and they don't always ride shotgun with one another.
Yeah.
Sometimes you demonstrate confidence through your behavior, even when you don't feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. sometimes you feel it and the external demonstration may not align that way. And I think those are related at parallel.
Yeah. So we've strayed slightly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But recap the first two for us that we've learned about.
Sure. So adults aren't magically adults. People don't magically become who you want them to be. And you will oftentimes project expectation and wish on somebody to demonstrate something that you want in them that is not them.
Allow them to learn both the skills, but also the softer skills, if you yep, will, the communication yep. skills.
Okay, and great. Then the other was basically the rank doesn't mean leadership in so many ways. And when you are in that spot that you are leading, do not just simply default stylistically to the one that you like, lead in the manner in which the people that need to be led, need to be led. The times that I am asking folks, are you leading people the way they currently need to be led at this stage in their career, at this stage in the organization, at this right. stage of the business? And the frequency with which people say, no, probably not. Okay, cool. Shift from a known point. We now know it. Now we need to get you to evolve it. Now that sounds easy on paper. It's harder, mm-hmm. of course, in real life. But so those are the first two. Third one. This was fun. On Naval Air Station Lemoore, Naval Air Base in Lemoore, California, there's the operations side of it, which is where all the jets are. And then there's the basically the living side of it, where housing is and commissary and living spaces. They're about 7 miles apart. So the deal was you get up in the morning, you get ready, usually hop on this shuttle, you take the shuttle across to the operations side. So I was what was known as the leading airman in this line division. So it's a low ranking enlisted position, but I was the most senior of the other airmen in that group. And I always got to work early, made sure jets were ready, made sure the team was ready, that the watch that was there was relieved. And so I was always in early doing the work that I needed to do. And I'd established a good relationship with my boss there, a guy named Steve Nadolny, incredible guy. On this particular morning, I wake up in my bed and it is like 9 a.m. And normally I am there at like 7 mm-hmm. and people get there at 8 at least. And I just am flooded with panic. Not only because I'm not there, it's a shuttle ride and 7 miles away. Like I can't get there right now.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh my gosh, harmonize your distress. I've totally screwed up. I'm getting dressed as fast as I can. I run to the shuttle stop and I have to wait for the shuttle, panicking and stressing. I hop on the bus. We get across. I go walking into the line division. It's called tail tucked. And my desk and Steve's desk, Petty Officer Nadolny's desk, like butt up against one another, right? He's sitting at his desk. I'm expecting to get kind of and nobody's called or anything, but there's really no way to call. You have a cell phone. This is, 1994.
Yeah, exactly. I mean.
They had to send a carrier pigeon. Morse code was coming through.
It's in black and white now in my head. John's military experience. that's good.
Different. So I go walking in and I sit down at my desk and, he just sort of like hands me a couple of things. And he's like, hey man, can you follow up on these pieces or check on this? And I was like, yeah, you bet. And I'm waiting and he's not saying anything. And I was like, oh. And so I couldn't let it happen anymore. And so I said, hey, man, I'm so sorry. I was late. And he goes, from what? And I said, like getting here. And he goes, what do you mean? And I said, I just got here. And he goes, I know. And I said, no, I just got to work. And he goes, oh. And he didn't seem upset. And I said, I got to ask, where did you think I was? And he said, I don't know. I just assumed you were doing all of the things that you would be doing. Halo effect and horn effect. Let me talk to both.
Okay.
There was a predictable, repeatable pattern of behavior that he had experienced from me. So he was extending a degree of grace onto me that was earned, but completely believed that there was no version where I would be late. If I wasn't there, it was because of I was actively doing something value added.
A good reason. Yeah.
His positive confirmation bias of me was informed by a series of credits I had made in our relationship and experience. And so his extension of latitude to me was, it wasn't even conscious. He just assumed you're doing good things. Yeah. There's no way you were doing something wrong. While that part is important, it's almost the other side of the equation that I realized from it. So the halo effect is a thing that people talk about all the time. This radiance from somebody that we then give them this. There's another one. I call it the horn effect. And it's the opposite of that. It's when the lived experience you've had with people that you choose to color the individual completely with that brush and that lens. And then all associated behavior that follows, you see it through that lens. Mm-hmm. Now, there are times that that's probably earned. Someone's behavior pattern is congruently and consistently doing something that's not aligned with what you want. But the biggest piece I learned from this one is that people will not change until you allow them to. If I lens an individual through a negative doorway, I will repeatedly find affirmations to see it that way, no matter what their behavior is, no matter how many times they do a nice job. Sometimes we extend the halo effect to people and we're unwilling to acknowledge the things that they are doing that are suboptimal. Mm-hmm. We don't walk at it. We don't address it. We don't deal with it. And sometimes the horn effect is in play where we are overly biasing a few vantage points that we have with the individual and we're not willing to consider the breadth of their capabilities. No matter what they do, we're going to constantly default to the problematic area.
I imagine it's interesting from your perspective when you are the coach or the third party, you don't have the built biases that the person does. So you hear them talk about somebody and you're like, man, I really don't feel like this evaluation is fair one way or the other.
Yeah.
And now you have to do your best to steer them to recognize that.
It's a perspective and a vantage point that they have based on their lived experience.
Right.
In all honesty, I tend to encourage people to go by that. Don't use the lived experience of someone else to inform your relationship with the person. Mm. If somebody tells you, yeah, that individual usually is X, Y, Z, well, that's their experience of them.
Right.
Don't overly interpret that through your lens. So that reality for me in the military in that time was, I benefited from the credits that I had deposited in that relationship. That's a positive thing.
Yeah.
It's probably also that somebody else that might've been a little more chronically late that showed up like that, they would have been lit up.
Yeah.
I wasn't
right
at all. So are we appropriately applying grace and judgment proportionately based on our relationship with the individual?
Exactly. So halo horn effect, number three.
Yes.
We got one more, I think.
One more.
Okay, let's hear it.
Probably the most powerful lived experience in the military for me. This is incredible. Leading airman.
I'm
leading airman and on this group, right? So it means I'm responsible for this group of men.
Okay.
And every 14 days at the time, it may be different now, the jets we were around had to be washed. Pretty simple. There's a wash job. It's a few hour job. You pull a jet over and you wash it like you wash a big car. They have a tactical paint scheme on them. So it means the paint is kind of rough and sticky. So it just stuff sticks to it. It's harder. And the absolute grossest place to clean is the nose landing gear. Because when a jet takes off of a ship, the catapult grease and debris, just like the windshield on a car, everything blows into that space. So it's kind of like, it's just yucky. So I'm the leading airman on this wash job for the first time. And my headspace of a leader, I am 18, maybe 19 at this point, was I needed to be in the trenches, like doing the hardest job. So I said, I will take the nose landing gear. I put on my chemical protective equipment. You get this chemical called Turco at the time. It's like slime. And in order to get into the nose landing gear, the bottom of the jet sits at about, let's call it 4.5 feet. So you kind of have to duck down and then step up in it. So imagine when you're standing in this landing gear, it's like you're in a box. It's 2 feet wide by 3 feet deep. And it's coming down to about middle of my chest, which means all I can see around me is just the interior of this thing. I'm in there and I'm applying this chemical and I'm scrubbing away and I feel a tug at my pant leg and I look down and it is black shoes and khaki pants. Now that means we're either a chief or we're an officer. We're someone of higher rank. I pop out and it's our chief. His name's Chief Jones, Senior Chief Jones. And he says, Airman Dyke, come over here with me. And we walk a ways. And he just directly looks at me and says, would you like me to remove a stripe? Demote me. And I said, Chief? And he goes, would you like me to remove a stripe? And I said, no. And he goes, I'm happy to. If you would like to have your head in the landing gear, cleaning that, I'll remove a stripe and you can do it. But if you're going to keep the stripe, then your job is not to have your head in the landing gear. Your job is the observation of resources. You have 10 individuals trying to safely, effectively, efficiently clean this multi-million dollar aircraft. And if you want to bury your head in the landing gear, then let's drop you back down in rank. Let's not have you lead this group. That has come up for me hundreds of times. I literally just spoke to a gentleman about this 2 days ago because he is a very senior leader that is so myopically focused based on his achievement drive that he leans into and wants to do a singular thing. He's not pulling back far enough to look at and leverage the collective space of all of your people, their assets, their strengths, their weakness areas. How do you manage the full chessboard rather than become just the pawn inside of it?
What I love about that, though, is not just the message or the story, which is incredible. It's the meaning behind it. I think oftentimes leaders will say, you know, no, I should lead, right?
Yeah.
But in your example, there's a belief that by taking the toughest job, you're sacrificing. And that's what a leader should do. They should be the one to do the dirty work, take the hard work.
In the trenches with your team.
Yes, ease the burden of the team. When in reality, although as noble as that may seem and how good it might feel, it is not the best allocation of your time.
Highest and best use. You're not operating at your highest point of execution. You're not of contribution. And that was really the first time someone leaned into with me on, I thought I was going to do the pleasing thing, the capable thing. I thought I was going to do the thing that my team would respect and what they needed. And it was not what was needed in that moment. They needed me to do the thing that they probably didn't want. I had to stand back. I had to put the brush down.
Which is often the hardest.
I had to not do the task.
Yeah.
I had to observe, give feedback, and guide the population that I was dealing with.
You had to lead.
So those were a few of some of the incredible early stage, for me, formations, no frameworks yet,
yeah,
but formations of understanding what it looked like to lead in complex and ambiguous situations early on in my years. And I think they became the foundational piece to me recognizing that you can try to lead through compliance. And in the military, you actually can. Mm. You have the collar insignia and the rank to do it.
Yep.
But if you create commitment and you demonstrate care and you support your people, you are going to get way more than just their hands. You get heart involved in it as well. And yeah, it was the first time that truth started landing on me is what it looked like to be a leader.
I love that. Thanks for bringing those stories, those narratives. Kind of bring these lessons to life. They stick with us as we then go on to lead. So appreciate you doing it.
You bet, man. Thanks for hanging out always.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks for joining us in the arena. If you want to keep growing, the best thing you can do is join our weekly newsletter. It's where we break down the biggest ideas from the podcast and share the tools and frameworks we use every day to help leaders live and lead differently. You can sign up for that at door2.com/sign-up. That is doortwo.com/sign-up. And if you enjoyed the conversation, make sure to follow or subscribe wherever you listen. If you prefer to watch, head over to YouTube and check out our full video episodes filmed right here in our on-site studio. And remember, all growth starts with self-awareness. We'll see you next time in the arena.